6 o'clock here on WMBR Cambridge. You're listening to Sverio, the local voice of our hemisphere. I'm Kendra Johnson. I'm here today with my co-host, Froilán Cifuentes.
Hola, hola a todos.
Y Amy Batistiache.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
We have an hour of news, music, and more here, and of course interviews here until 7 p.m. on WMBR Cambridge. But of course, before we begin, we'd like to remind our listeners that the views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the faculty of the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT. And a shout out to any listeners who are listening from other countries. And from our archives at web.mit.edu/hemisphere. So stay tuned. We have a really exciting show today, focusing on some MIT American Indian connections. We have two graduate students at MIT in the studio with us who have both been doing work with American Indian groups in the United States recently. And they're here to tell us about their experiences and their perspectives, and we're really excited to have them. So first, Nick Buchanan. He is a PhD candidate in a program on the history and social study of science and technology, and he's been doing work with the Klamath tribes out in Oregon. So welcome, Nick.
Thank you.
And we also have Amit Sarin, who is in the master's program, right, in city planning in the Urban Studies and Planning Department. And he it was in January, correct, that you went to a Navajo Nation and did some work out there.
That is correct.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So before we begin with these interviews, we have a few news pieces, as always, as we start off our show on Sverio. And then we'll jump right into this discussion. Free? All right, so our first news story is actually sort of a sad one, which is some of you may remember Diana Gomez, who was on Sverio not too many weeks back, who was an activist in Colombia. She, along with many other organizers of the March 6th demonstration against all of the violence in Colombia, has received death threats from Águilas Negras, which is a paramilitary group there. And she, along with others, are working to try to get protection from the Colombian government, but it's not coming. They haven't received protection. And so, you know, we and others are concerned about her. And if you're interested in finding out more, you can contact us. We can give you some information about how you could write some letters or make some phone calls to try to help get these people protection in Colombia. So that reminds me that you can contact us here at the studio, 617-253-8810, and email us at sverio@wmbr.org. So then the next news story is that we have a success story of a union strike that happened, actually a union boycott, really, which was happening with Napa Valley's Charles Krug Mondavi Winery, where 24 employees were fired and had called for a boycott. And it actually now, 2 years later, has worked, and they've been re-signed. Y en español.
¿En dónde fue? ¿En California?
California, en Napa Valley.
En Napa Valley ha habido un boicot que es una... Que se dicen que no deben comprar una marca de vinos.
Sí.
Porque fueron... ¿Cómo se dice? Fueron despedidos 24 miembros de la compañía Charles Krug Mondavi. Y afortunadamente esta es una historia de éxito y... Han sido regresados al trabajo y ahora tienen un nuevo contrato después de haber sido despedidos hace 2 años, en diciembre del 2005.
Qué bueno, unas noticias positivas. And the last news story we have, this comes from Democracy Now. The World Bank has just joined warning calls of a global crisis over the rising cost of food. Thursday, the World Bank called on wealthy nations to commit at least $500 million more dollars to ease a world food program shortfall because the price of rice has risen 75% over the last 2 years, hitting poor people the hardest. ¿Y en español?
El Banco Mundial adhirió a las advertencias de la crisis mundial por el creciente costo de los alimentos. El jueves, el presidente del Banco Mundial, Robert Zoellick, exhortó a las naciones ricas a que se comprometan a contribuir con al menos $500 millones para calmar el déficit del Programa Mundial de Alimentos. Zoellick dijo que los precios del arroz han aumentado 75% en los últimos 2 años, afectando mucho más a las personas más pobres.
Gracias, Freelan. 75%, imagínate.
Es bastante.
Yeah, it's, I think even in the United States, and we're starting to see that too, about how much food prices have gone up recently. All right. So that's it for the news. For the rest of the program, we're going to be enjoying a discussion with Nick and Amit about their experiences with the Navajo Nation and Klamath tribes in Oregon. And intermix that with a little bit of music and maybe a Radialistas piece, some announcements, and that'll be great. So to start us off, I'd like to hear a little bit from each of you about sort of where you're coming at this personally. What made you be interested in working with American Indian Nations? How did this sort of slide into your academic careers as well? So Amit or Nick, whichever.
Can I start?
Oh, sure. Well, I first went to the Klamath Basin in 2001, actually as an undergraduate when I was at UC Berkeley, and I went there on a field trip with a geography class. We went up there to look at volcanoes. It's a volcanically active place in Northern California and Southern Oregon. But it turned out in 2001 there was a kind of explosion of a very different sort going on. There was a major enforcement action under the Endangered Species Act that had actually shut off irrigation water to about 200,000 acres of farmland in order to keep the water levels up, which regulatory agencies were claiming were essential for the survival of the fish. Mm-hmm. And when you were in the basin at the time, the signs of racism were very, very apparent. And in fact, they were physical signs. People had posted makeshift billboards on the side of the road about the fish and blaming directly or indirectly the Klamath tribes, the native group in the area. And I became convinced as I thought about this a little bit more that tribal history was essential for understanding how this conflict was playing out. And it also meshed very well with an interest that I have in the social dimensions of knowledge production, the politics of science, essentially, in that scientific experts were playing an incredibly large role in the conflict, in trying to come up with a solution, in advocating for different sides in it. And so I remained interested in it over the next several years and eventually decided to do my dissertation research on it. And I thought it would be a very interesting place to go and look and see how indigenous rights, indigenous environmental issues are playing out in the modern day, to look at how people who know the environment very differently and who value it in very different ways can actually come together and try to work out some sort of solution. And it turned out it became very quickly very complex. I suppose I can talk about that a little bit more later on.
Yeah.
But that's a sort of background of my
I'm curious about this field trip. Was it about this issue that you went on this
field
trip?
No, actually, we went up to look at the geology of the area.
Okay.
I mean, like I said, it's a volcanically active place still. And so, yeah, that's the reason that we went up there, and this was going on. I mean, we knew it was going on, but it really eclipsed everything else in the area at the time.
And Nick, I just wondered, because we do get people coming in from all over the world doing our shows with us, you are originally from that part of the country?
Yes, I'm from the West Coast, Berkeley, California, actually.
Uh-huh. And do you consider yourself Klamath at all?
Oh, no, I don't.
How about you, Amit?
For me, it actually, I think, took a completely different journey, which was I come out of community organizing and youth work, professionally and personally. So from when I was 16 in Boston, I've been a peer educator and a political educator and a youth organizer. And so my mission in life more largely is to connect struggles of marginalized peoples and disempowered groups to kind of have access to and build capacity within those communities. And so I've been doing that very hands-on for most of my life, and I've come to grad school to try to understand new ways and leverage new resources to do that. And one of the ways I'm looking at doing that is through this upward swing in the growth of the green industry and renewable energy and so forth. And so I've been looking and working with groups and people locally in Boston and Cambridge to understand how this growth can not just provide better opportunities for the environment and how we operate societally, with regard to the environment, but also provide opportunities and address some larger inequities in society around race, class, and other issues. And so my introduction into working with indigenous populations and going to Navajo Nation was understanding and trying to bring some of these connections together more broadly. So how does our struggle here in Boston relate to those people in Navajo folks in Navajo Nation, and what is going on with the climate there, and what kind of development are they taking, and what are some opportunities for community capacity development as well as economic development at the local level to take place, as opposed to kind of this corporate-centric growth that, that has been happening and continues to happen with coal mining and so forth. And that's, I mean, that's one of my interests in being at MIT and more largely in my life, is understanding how to leverage some of the influence and access that I have and that we have to work with communities that don't have that access.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about your work at the Navajo Nation? In what context did you go, and what sort of a work were you doing?
Definitely. So Larry, Professor Larry Susskind, of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning, has started a relationship with Navajo Nation and with an organization, a nonprofit called Diné Inc., to look at how peacemaking and peacebuilding. Peacemaking is a traditional form of conflict resolution that is that Navajos have practiced for forever, as far as I know. Understanding how that can play a role in with regard to environmental justice issues that are currently facing the nation. And so through the Program on Negotiations and through the Department of Urban Studies and Planning, a group of Harvard and MIT students, including me, went over IAP to understand three specific areas with regard to environmental justice. So we looked at building social capital among the environmental justice nonprofits, the Bennett Freeze, which is a highly disputed land area between the Hopi and Navajo tribes, and I was looking at renewable energy growth and what ways that Navajo Nation was developing and what opportunities there were for renewable energy growth and what role peacemaking could play in all of those different disputes and conflicts.
Amit, before we go to a music break, could you explain what does traditional peacemaking sort of encompass? What is that?
I'll try. I definitely don't know how much I can, you know, do it justice. But really, it's, I mean, my understanding is that it's an approach to life more broadly than a way of resolving conflicts and disputes. And so one of the things that Judge Robert Yazzie shared with us that was really helpful for me in understanding it is there's an ancient traditional Navajo life way, which understands how you should operate in life, not just with when conflicts arise. But the four major segments he highlighted were all interactions begin in relationship and understanding your relation to someone else, to the people in the room, and establishing that through your family history, your ancestors, and so forth. And then talking things out, which is broadly kind of talking about where we're at, what has happened, what has transpired, what are people's current realities and viewpoints. And third is consensus building. So from that initial grounding of who we are, how we relate to each other and where we're at, how do we build consensus around what has happened and where we want to go, and then finally, relief, which is a process of resolving the conflict, dispute, or misunderstanding, or whatever else it may be, through everyone understanding how they can move forward in a way that most people or everyone agrees with. And so peacemaking is kind of like a process and a way of integrating the life way and those four approaches to interacting with people into resolving conflicts, be they interpersonal, societal, legal, or whatever else.
Nick, did you see any of a sort of a similar or very different kind of approach to understanding relationships and conflict and with the climate?
It's interesting because my project is very much focused around negotiations as well, and I'm interested in the way that these very complicated environmental disputes are negotiated and hashed out sort of on the ground in a very sort of everyday kind of way. What are the tools people use? How do people approach these? And so, yes, I did see this idea of negotiation happen. The forums that I was looking at, though, are very much the forums that are sort of framed by environmental regulations and environmental laws and movements towards more participatory, community-based environmental governance. And so I was really, my project is more focused on this, I suppose, the way that different groups have integrated themselves into this process, the Klamath tribes being one of many,
Great. We'll continue this discussion after a brief musical interlude.
The music that we're going to jump into here is from the Crossroads recording, something off of Canyon Records, which is probably one of the best known of Native American recording artists, recording labels. And we put this song on because it is what happens when you bring great people together. And great musical traditions together. In this case, this is Robert Tree Cody from the Dakota Nation and Javier Quijas, who is Huichol. And they combine music from the northern and Central American regions. This is actually the title cut, Crossroads.
Hi, I'm Trisha Yearwood. It might surprise you to learn that lung cancer is the number one cancer killer of women. I lost both my grandmothers to lung cancer, and their death turned my life inside out. Today, death rates from lung cancer are declining in men, but rising big time in women. To learn more, visit the Society for Women's Health Research at www.hercancer.com or call 1-866-HER-CANCER. Don't let lung cancer turn your life inside out.
And that was a message here on Sverio, the local voice of our hemisphere. You can contact us here in the studio, 617-253-8810, if you have any questions or comments. We're enjoying a discussion here with Nicholas Buchanan and Amit Sarin, who are graduate students here at MIT and who have recently been working with indigenous communities within the United States. And so I'd like to give you each the opportunity to sort of more clearly describe exactly what your work has been over the last January, or over the last year, the times that you've spent in these communities, so that we can sort of open it up to the larger issues involved in that work. So, Nick, you want to begin?
Yeah, sure. I spent the last year in the Klamath Basin working with the Klamath tribes and others, landowners, doing interviews in federal state agencies, talking to people in conservation NGOs. And really what I was interested in looking at was the dynamics of these complex environmental negotiations. And that centered in one way or another, I think, around different ways of valuing the environment and thinking about the human place in nature. And one of the reasons that I chose to concentrate, sort of focus on the Klamath tribes, is that increasingly scientists and science is playing a larger and larger role in identifying, describing, and coming up with solutions to environmental problems. Indigenous groups have their own very sophisticated ways of producing environmental knowledge and meaning that many people would say are distinct from Western science, or what most people think of Western science. What struck me as very interesting is that the Klamath tribes had a very well-developed research program and had a number of biologists, chemists, water quality scientists working for them. And so, interestingly, they had chosen to embrace in one way or another scientific ways of knowing the environment. And my question was, why was that, and what sort of conflicts has that caused in and of itself? And basically my research involved following scientists around, trying to figure out how it is that they know the environment. How do they produce knowledge about the environment? How is that then integrated into decision making? And can we figure out why it is that problems are or are not resolved as a result? Is there some sort of relationship between the way that knowledge is produced and the way that an environmental issue is addressed? I alluded a little bit earlier to my suspicion in 2001 that tribal history was very important to the area. There is an underlying history there of environmental rights that were guaranteed in a treaty between the Klamath tribes and the United States that has been superimposed onto a very complicated set of jurisdictions. So you have federal jurisdiction, state jurisdiction, private property. You have new environmental laws like the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act, all of which are coming together, and all of which sort of place a different value, a different kind of value on the environment, and describe a different way of people living in the environment. And one thing that, let's talk about the Endangered Species Act in particular. It talks about a very specific way of supporting arguments about whether or not a species should be protected, listed as endangered, threatened, what have you. And that way is through science. That way really depends on what the Act calls the best available scientific and commercial data. And so within the Act, which is very important in the basin because there are a number of endangered species, it's hard to move in the basin without somehow encountering the Endangered Species Act, there is so the Act authorizes a certain way of knowing the environment, which is science. And I started to wonder whether this would create a sort of a complicated situation for people who have other ways of knowing the environment, whether they be indigenous ones, whether they come from a long history of a family history of farming and ranching in the area. And so in particular, I look at these, in my dissertation work, I look at these conflicts over the management of endangered species, habitat and big game, and then also attempts to restore environments to address these problems. There's a growing consensus, I think, in the environmental community that the solution to environmental conflict may be restoring environments to and this is really a very problematic thing, I think, and something I try to get at in my dissertation, but restoring environments to something that's maybe more a little bit more natural. And so I try to question, you know, in each of these instances, how the different groups, the climate tribes, landowners, agencies, come together and oftentimes, unfortunately, kind of speak over each other's shoulder.
Mm-hmm. I know that in my ecology sorts of courses that I've taken, I've also, I'm not even indigenous, but I sort of start learning all the different scientific terms mm-hmm. that we apply to different things, and how do you classify whether a lake is in a certain
right,
state
right.
or not, and how do you classify the diversity of a field or whatever. And, it strikes me as so artificial and so sort of constrained or made up, and then I don't think is there a better way to do it either? And
yeah.
So I'm wondering as these scientists who have sort of both a traditional understanding of the environment, maybe even deeper than I do, and then they also have
right.
a great deal of knowledge about the science of how to analyze it. Did you have conversations with them about where that puts them or how they feel about that?
Yeah, I guess I'd start just by saying I don't know if artificial or if we really want to talk about better or worse ways. I mean, the Endangered Species Act came about at a particular scientific moment in U.S. history. I mean, it came about at a time of growing environmental awareness on the one hand in the population in general, but also at a particular scientific moment, a moment where the sciences of ecology were really blossoming. The very idea of a species, the way we define species as opposed to, say, a hybrid or a subspecies or something like that, derives very directly out of evolutionary biology and, is increasingly becoming complicated as new genomic sort of research comes in and says, wait a second, these boundaries between species that we used to think were so, impassable are actually much more fluid. So, it's important to understand that it comes out of a certain scientific moment as well and kind of inscribes that into the law, and since that law is very powerful, you end up in a situation where you have to sort of speak about the environment in a certain way in order to make a claim based on the act. And speaking that language is science. In terms of, I guess, your question about whether there are conflicts between this. I mean, there always are. I mean, some of us are being at MIT, we're sort of steeped in this, in the discourses and rhetorics of science, and so for us, it's sort of very natural to think in terms of ecosystems or something like that. And to a certain extent, you might say that this idea of interlinked, species and habitats and what have you is sort of shared amongst different groups. But to think, I mean, ecology is more than that. It's talking about links of, say, energy or something like that, in a very, very materialist, tangible sort of way. Calories from food, right? I think for a lot of people who aren't kind of steeped in that, that's actually not the first way, That's
right.
not the first way that they think about the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find, I know in my work, in my time in Navajo Nation, I found that one of the big distinctions in terms of how people wanted to develop and how they wanted the nation to
mm-hmm.
grow was a cultural understanding and relationship to the land and to nature.
Absolutely.
And one could almost be called like a resource-driven understanding, so seeing nature as a resource to be utilized for maximum production
right.
or growth or economic development versus a more traditional understanding as the earth almost as family. And as something to be valued in relationship to all
absolutely,
of us,
there's a deep sort of experiential, very close relationship amongst tribal members and the environment, and it's almost incorrect to say to make that distinction, right? Because for them, it's a very important part of their day-to-day lives. It's an area that does not have a very large population, and those sort of realities of being in the woods is and interacting with the environment. I mean, it's a lived and worked landscape. for everyone, and but in different ways. It's hunted, it's fished, it's farmed. So yes, there definitely there is that.
Well, I'm saying more in terms of like outside agents kind of looking at the land differently from inside or treating it differently. Because I agree with you that we all interact with everything in a certain way, you know, but either understanding kind of a reciprocity and or just extraction.
It's interesting when we start talking about these sorts of things, how native groups, how indigenous groups interact with the environment. You know, there's a lot of association with and you know, this started along with the sort of rising environmental awareness in the U.S. public, an association of American Indians with environmentalism. And one thing that I was very surprised is that a lot of native groups don't feel that connection that sort of more, you know, larger society kind of ascribes to them. They use the environment. And then that leads to very sort of interesting questions about tribal sovereignty. If, for instance, you know, in the Navajo Nation, energy, of course, is a gigantic issue, and it's been for a long time because there's been energy mining there. And, you know, a question sometimes does come up with, you know, should a tribe have the, you know, should they be able to allow a mining company in and, you know, dig up a pit mine or something like that? And to me, it boils down to tribal sovereignty. And that they have the decision about how they want to interact with the environment. And that's something that they have to hash out internally.
Right.
I was wondering if we could actually get into that a little bit.
It leads right into kind of my project.
That's what I was thinking.
Perfect transition. So, I mean, I guess I'll get to the history of it in a second, but one of the things I was looking at is how that hashing out takes place and what are some of the power dynamics therein. And so I personally, within a larger group that was looking at a whole bunch of things, tried to identify the different approaches to development. And so there is this long history in the Navajo Nation of what I call, and we might disagree, a resource-driven approach from external agents. So from outside companies coming in the 1940s and beginning uranium mining. Uranium mining in the 40s that ended in the 60s, and recently President Joe Shirley has passed a law to outlaw uranium mining moving forward, but that as a source of energy, energy
and
production.
Tragic health.
Yeah, and still existing. Effects. I mean, there's open uranium pits that haven't been closed still on the Navajo Nation that people are living close to, that animals still access and so forth. But moved into the 60s into a lot of coal-related plants and mining, and that's the ongoing struggle in terms of environmental resources and depletion. Part of the relationship that's really critical is who benefits from the utilization and extraction of these resources. And so both with uranium mining and with the current coal mining, it's outside corporations coming in and the Navajo government either leasing the land or individual people on the eastern side of the nation who have this checkered board ownership, so they can lease land without the rest of the land is owned by the nation as a whole. And so the nation at Window Rock, which is where the government is, makes decisions as to who to give land to and what kind of development can take place. But who owns what happens on that land, or who is leased the ownership of that land for a certain amount of time, and then where does that energy production go? So Navajo Nation produces an incredible amount of energy, most of which goes to California and Las Vegas and kind of powers the strip, whereas a great percentage of people in the nation themselves are not hooked up to any grid, don't have running water, don't have electricity. And so what I was looking at is how are these decisions made, who makes them? And so Navajo Nation is semi-sovereign. So Window Rock does make the decisions, but a lot of the people, the grandmas and the people who live on the land aren't benefiting from these decisions.
The way that I started to think about it with the Klamath tribes, because their situation is pretty interesting, is a kind of emerging sovereignty, continually negotiated, continually in need of being, you know, stood up for. The Klamath tribes don't actually have a reservation today. They did have one. The treaty with the U.S. government does provide for a reservation. However, in the 1950s, they were one of the tribes that was terminated. Termination was a government policy, essentially, to end federal recognition and support of tribes. And in the process of that, their reservation was lost. So prior to termination, they actually had a sustained yield forestry business, lumber business. And this was actually one of the things in sort of a horrible twist of irony that sort of marked them for the termination policy in the beginning, is that because of their logging, sustained yield logging business, they were actually, at least in the spectrum of Native American tribes, fairly well off. And so the government or certain people in Congress saw them as being closer to not needing federal assistance anymore. Now, today, their former reservation is National Wildlife Refuge. Most of it is national forest, a lot of private land. So a variety of different jurisdictions. And the National Forest, of course, is, I mean, it's a multi-use agency. And so they sell timber. And it's a So there's a continual negotiation because the tribes do retain rights, environmental rights for hunting, fishing, and gathering, as well as water, to be involved in the management of those lands that are technically under the jurisdiction of someone else now.
Right. So they're forced to continually be entering these conversations and negotiating for their own rights with a whole bunch of exterior entities. Whereas in your project, I mean, it's more within the Navajo Nation.
Yeah,
how are they deciding what happens with their resources? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but they have sort of more control over what happens because they have the sovereignty.
Right. They do, but it's complicated. So
it's a limited sovereignty.
It's limited. I mean, the federal government grants them sovereignty. So sovereignty obviously can never really be granted if it's true sovereignty, just as freedom can never be granted if it's true freedom. And so similar issues come up. So the issue of casinos and gambling has come up and is a current issue on Navajo Nation. And there are certain rights to sovereign action that will be changed if they go forward with gambling with regard to the federal government. And so it's true that it's within I'm looking at within Navajo Nation, how is culture constructed and how is it negotiated and how does that relate to what type of development, and looking at if renewables and community owned renewables is actually what I'm really looking at can provide an alternative form of development. But there is external actors still play a large role, though some of that comes through Window Rock and through the government's lens and agency as well. Yeah. There's also existing leases and contracts and mines that, you know, were signed for 99 years that still exist. And so this group, Black Mesa Water Coalition, closed, you know, a plant, the Mohave Power Plant and the Black Mesa mining plant, I think 4 or 5 years ago. I might be wrong. I'll check. And so there's like civil society taking action upon pre-existing leases and agreements. But, you know, it's like constant negotiation.
The layers are endless.
Yeah. Right.
And another thing is that states have traditionally seen Native American tribes as sort of a gap in their own sovereignty. So American Indians become a states' rights issue.
Right.
And you see this especially in casinos, where tribes have to apply through the state in addition to a federal process. You see it a lot with hunting and fishing rights and the sort of regulation of that. The states are always, you know, they always get very agitated that there is either a reservation or a group of people within their borders that is not under all of their laws, that have sort of a workaround to a federal level of authority.
Yeah, so this is Ferio, the local voice of our hemisphere on WMBR Cambridge. We're talking with Nick Buchanan and Amit Sarin, who are graduate students here at MIT, talking about their work and perspectives from working with indigenous communities here in the United States. And we'll continue this discussion after some music and hopefully get a chance to talk about some of the positive, you know, what a discussion of what these groups are working towards, whether it be renewable energy, restoration, and sort of the complexities of those sorts of goals. So what are we listening to, Amy?
Well, This is off of the Sacred Spirits CD, a recording that was actually put together by the Native American Fund. Let me see if I have that right. Native American Rights Fund. I was going to say backwards. So this particular cut is not really well labeled, so I can't even tell you what language it's in. Isn't that great? But I can tell you that it is wishing us happiness and prosperity, so that can't be bad. And we'll hear a little bit of that and then come back and talk some more with our guests.
So Amit, I heard that you're really, you know, mentioning maybe a transition from coal and the path of nuclear energy has happened in Navajo Nation to renewables. Can you, you know, talk a little bit about that? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. It really gets at what I was focusing on and what one of my main interests are. So there's, you know, as far as I understand it, there's various ways we can develop in this world in general. And in Navajo Nation, I see a spectrum, but I see two really opposing ends. One that is kind of this modernist development and really pro outside corporations that currently have capital and have access and are already doing energy development, coming in and utilizing the quote-unquote resources that are in the land, be it coal, be it uranium, be it whatever it might be. One concrete example of that is that Scythe Global has a new plant planned and approved by the Navajo Nation, the Desert Rock plant, that will displace a number of families as well as have huge environmental consequences for those
living. Is that a coal plant?
It is a coal plant, living on the land. So that's one form of development, but it will also bring a certain type of revenue and a certain type of income and economic development to the Navajo Nation. So for instance, mining accounted in 2003 to 2005 for 56% of the general fund budget of the Navajo Nation. So it's over 50% of kind of their larger budget. And then in 2006, it was 42% because, as I mentioned before, Black Mesa Water Coalition fought to close the Mohave power plant and the Black Mesa mine. And that was in 2005, so that's the correction. But there's another form of development that can take place, and people on the reservation are fighting for and working in, which is more community-centric renewable development. And so there's a group, Kaya Earth, that builds within sustainable guidelines and builds with the with the materials local to Navajo Nation, mm-hmm. In a sustainable fashion, and empowers people to be involved in that building and do it themselves. And so what I was looking at is what is the potential for off-the-grid, community-owned renewable development, so be it solar or wind. There's, you know, Navajo Nation and the land in many ways are kind of perfect for both solar and wind development in terms of how much wind comes through, in terms of the sunlight there, in terms of the open land and so forth. And it also allows for people, because it's, you know, it's scattered, it's not hugely dense in terms of how people live in buildings and so forth. So it allows for people who are, you know, surrounded by no one for as far as the eye can see, to have their own source of electricity, to get running water and develop their own piece of property and where they live in their community as they see fit, and as an economic driver for those folks instead of an outside corporation benefiting from that development.
We had a guest on Sferio a while back who was working with a sort of cooperative model for putting in solar, I think it was wind systems, yeah. Mostly, but renewable systems within the United States for communities or for a group of families wanted to come together and do that. And, you know, she was talking about sort of the collective cooperative model works mm-hmm. pretty well here because, you know, these individual families couldn't do it, but when they pool their resources, they can. So what's the sort of model to be able to get the capital? You know, talked about outside corporations
right.
have the capital, they can put in systems like this, but where do you get the sort of upfront capital from to do something like this?
Yeah, and it's a big question. And one of the things that I'm looking at is if Window Rock, what role peacemaking can play in Window Rock coming to understand some of the consequences environmentally as well as societally for Navajo Nation of this outside mining-centric development so that the government themselves can move forward in a way that supports local renewables. So there isn't at the local level necessarily a lot of capital to do this kind of development. Navajo Nation is divided into different chapters, which kind of have governance over their own areas. And so there's this Local Governance Act, which is recent, and I think about 8 chapters or 9 chapters have applied and been granted full local governance over their land, so they can do business development and so forth. And there's another number of chapters which have a different level. But what the LGA provides for is the ability for a chapter to do their own development plan and to build up either small businesses or to install renewables and so forth. So there is an opportunity structurally, but the funding isn't there. And one of the big issues in Navajo Nation is there's a large impediment in terms of how long it takes for a business to start up. I think it's like 5 years for a business to get a grant to start up, to get the permit from Navajo Nation. So a lot of it is internal in terms of the nation coming to terms with the impediments for local economic development, and in terms of stressing that and providing capital in a certain way, because there is money in the Navajo Nation. It's not a ton, but the direction they go with it alters a lot who benefits and what path it takes.
And I know you have to go, but I really want to thank you for taking the time to come out here on Sferio. And if you have any last words you'd like to say before we have to send you off on your way.
I want to thank you for inviting me, and definitely Nick and everyone in the studio. And I also want to give a shout out to my family and friends in Boston, worldwide, Rob Redstair, DNA Inc., for being wonderful hosts and friends, Department of Urban Studies and Planning here at MIT, and all the professors, Professor Larry Susskind and the negotiations program, and to the City School, which is a little off cut, but it is folks that I've been working with and I've been a part of for the majority of my life and play a big role in who I am. So thank you to all of you and all of them, and good luck on the rest of the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So Nick Ahmed has mm-hmm. sort of shared with us his vision of what might be a positive direction that the Navajo Nation could go. How about in your research, what is sort of the positive direction that the tribe wants to move or is trying to move?
Well, one of the big huge positives that has happened is that the tribe, although they were terminated in the 1950s, fought long and hard to have their federal status restored, and they succeeded in this in the 1980s. And so they're once again a federally recognized tribe, with you know, everything that goes along with that, sovereignty, social services, the ability to self-determine. So this is one of the very big things that has happened in the Klamath Basin, that's definitely a positive move. Another thing is that, you know, my dissertation looks at conflicts and negotiations. But one thing that most people seem to agree on is that one solution to environmental conflict may be ecological restoration, which is actually going in and rebuilding environments, going in and addressing areas that are in some way deemed to be degraded or less than what they should be, and remaking them so that they function better, so that they're essentially removing the source, or at least that's the goal of restoration, is to remove the reason for the conflict in the first place. And so this is, you know, at least one thing that everyone seems to agree on. But one thing that I look at in my dissertation, and you know, talk to a lot of people who are involved in restoration, the tribes, it's a very important part of their environmental program. And it's also something that's increasingly being done by landowners, irrigators, farmers, and ranchers. It's something that agencies, federal agencies like the Forest Service, are looking at. How can we remake our forests to be more like they used to be? One thing that I found that is very interesting in it is like other debates about the environment, to say those involving the Endangered Species Act, scientists play an incredibly large role in the process of restoration, in both sort of determining. Well, when you talk about restoration, you're talking about going back to something. And there's inevitably a debate about what we're going back to. And there's an assumption on the part of some people that we're kind of going back to nature. For me, a big eye-opening thing going to the basin is how much it is a lived and worked and used landscape. You know, I will admit, I grew up in Berkeley, California, you know, environmentalist, all of this sort of thing. I came to realize very quickly that our choices aren't between farming and some sort of open space devoid of people anymore. The choices are between farming and subdivisions. And you know what? Farming can be done in a good way that is ecologically sustainable, that is economically feasible, all of this sort of thing. My personal bias is that in these areas, better than subdivisions. But you get into these debates about what we're restoring for, what we're restoring to. And this ends up taking us into questions about how people view the human place in nature. Is the landscape that we're restoring to one of ranches,
mm-hmm.
albeit ranches that maybe don't cause quite as much as erosion or use other practices that limit invasives or something like that, invasive
right.
species. And one thing that I worry a little bit about restoration is that in its focus on fixing the physical environment, on restoring what a river channel looks or preventing erosion, that it might overlook some of the social causes of the degradation in the first place. So in a way, it's designed not to be a Band-Aid. It's designed to address the cause. But maybe there's one cause even a step farther back than that. And that's, you know, I'm thinking here about, you know, rural economic transformation, the poverty in a lot of areas over here. You know, why is it that loggers felt the need to clear cut? Why
right.
is it that farmers felt the need to farm in a certain way, use pesticides? Or why is it that ranchers felt that they had to put that density of cattle on the land? And I think those are really the underlying questions, and they get at, you know, how people live in the environment. And, you know, it's important that these be addressed as well as just, you know, the physical state of the environment.
Nick, I'm so glad you said that, because we're running right up against the end of our show. But that's such an interesting point that, you know, we observed. We worked in a community in Ecuador, in an indigenous community there. And, you know, a lot of them were firmly opposed to logging and never did it. And a lot of families did when they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that exact question, why do we have environmental degradation? And there's sort of that cause that comes one step before, which is why are the people who live in those environments, why they need to do these different things and right. farming practices and all that. I guess I'll offer you also that final word opportunity before we give you some announcements and then send people off to Music for Human Beings, which comes on at 7.
Well, I think I'll just limit it to the Klamath tribes, the folks in the Klamath tribes who were just absolutely amazing and very welcoming and willing to share and speak to me and let me follow them around, basically, finding out what they do, how they think about the world. That was just an invaluable experience and something that they, you know, didn't have to do. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and I hope your sharing of some of their perspectives and stories might help us all be more aware of the realities of what's going on and how we might be able to change things in the future. We have a couple announcements. I have one that's very important, which is Massachusetts Power Shift, which is a statewide conference on climate change. It's going to be huge and in Boston this weekend. So if you're interested, you can register right at the events and at any of them. And so the website is www.masspowershift.org. Amy, you have an announcement or two to share?
I have one or two, yes. Tonight, if you are feeling the need to shake your bunda, as they would say in Portuguese, you might want to get out and check out the Ashe program that's happening in the south end of Boston. Afro Brazil is presenting dance and music from the Brazilian traditions of maracatu, ijexá, capoeira, samba, candomblé, many other types of things. That's starting tonight at 9 o'clock at the Jorge Hernandez Cultural Center, which is, of course, 85 West Newton Street, near the Back Bay T-Stop. You can get info on tickets at claboston.org. Tomorrow, if you are not going to be going to the Massachusetts Power Shift event, and you're interested in the Youth Peace Conference of Somerville, check that out. It is being run by Teen Empowerment Youth and the City of Somerville. It's going to be an all-day event happening at Somerville High School, starting at 11:30, going all the way to 5 p.m. There will be music by DJ Maverick from Jammin' 94.5, and poetry and theater and many, many, many other things in the name of youth uniting. And then on Sunday, the conference on the roots of migration in Boston, being run by Witness for Peace, from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock in the evening at the Community Church of Boston, located at 565 Boylston Street. That's in Copley Square, the Copley T-Stop on the Green Line. You can learn about migration and sort of how we got to where we are today and many other interesting things that will be happening there. As always, if you have stuff that you want Sferio and our listeners to know about, you can contact us at Sferio at WM.